A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. Become a paid member and get ad-free episodes and early access to episodes. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
I love these moments.
See a man in a dress come through here, haircut like the Three Stooges?
When the violence comes, it comes fast. And it's over. You can never really be sure. Did I draw first? Did he?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Streaming, a Decoding TV podcast. I am David Chen, and I started a line of business, and I'm secretly paying everyone around Jessie to make her life a living hell. Joining me today is Jessie Earle.
Well, I was just going to say that I really hope my debt to you is fully paid, or at least hopefully you can forgive it, but I guess not.
Indeed. Well, welcome to This Week in Streaming. Now, if you're listening to this podcast and you're refreshing that feed every day, you might have seen we just launched a new weekly format where every week we're going to talk about stuff that's going on in the industry, as well as recap some of the things we've been talking about. That is going to continue. That's going to be the primary way that this podcast is released each week. But we do still have some commitments. As I said on another podcast this week, a Chanister always pays his debts. We had committed to review the end of Fargo season 5, so we are here to do that. We also committed weeks ago to review The Crown final few episodes. That has not happened yet, but hopefully will in the near future. But yes, please do tune in to our weekly format with me, Patrick Klepek, as well as hopefully other cool guests in the future. But yeah, we're doing This Week in Streaming on occasion for a show like Fargo, and especially when we've already committed to doing a show like Fargo for This Week in Streaming. So, Jessie Earle, I do also want to say that typically we are extremely organized. We have like a full recap and organized notes about what we're going to talk about. And this episode is going to be a little bit looser because we weren't actually planning to record it for another few days. But then my flight to Sundance got canceled. And so I ended up having a little pocket of time today. And so now we are here recording. I just got Jesse. I contacted Jesse. I said, hey, I can record today right before I fly to Park City. And she said, well, I didn't even watch it last night. I can watch it this morning. And then we barely got it under the wire. So if it sounds a little bit more loose or like we're reaching for some details more so than we usually would, that is why. But I'm so grateful that Jesse's here for us to talk about the final episodes of Fargo Season 5. You can find more episodes of the show at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the podcast of Fargo and all the stuff that's going on. Find us across all platforms at Decoding TV. All right, Jessie Earle, let's start by talking about our overall thoughts on how Fargo Season 5 wrapped up, and specifically the finale. Do you think this season of television stuck the landing, and would you recommend it?
I think for the most part, this season stuck the landing. I think the lead up into the finale was really excellent. I think there's a couple big swing episodes, one in particular that I think is a real like stretch in terms of what it's going for. And I think it really, really hits it and has some very strong messages around how women are treated, abuse and power and abuse of power and patriarchy and all of that stuff that the first half of the season was setting up. And I think it hits it off pretty well. And then we get to the finale. And like I said, I just watched it a little while ago, so I haven't fully like sat with it for a long time like I normally would for these podcasts. But my initial feeling coming out of it is that I think it was a very strong finale, and I think the final few moments of it are excellent. But I think there's a few beats here and there that either rub me the wrong way in terms of what it's saying with its overall themes, as well as sometimes I think running counter to a couple of its ideas. But on the whole, I think there's this whole second half of the season has like really clever moments, really clever beats, some big swings, and I think a overall really great message that falters in some places as it's like getting into the final stretch.
I think I pretty much agree 100% with everything you said. Overall, I thought the season was excellent. One of the best things I've watched on TV in the last year, I would say, like just a really solid season of television. Very memorable, great themes, great sequences. You're watching a show that, in my opinion, is firing on all cylinders. I had a great time watching it. I had a great time talking with you about it on our last This Week in Streaming. So, yeah, that said, I think the word I'd use for the finale is uneven. And it was, I will say, it was made further uneven for me by the fact that I watched the finale live. All the other episodes I watched on Hulu, and I watched the finale live, and there was an ad like every 7 minutes. And so an ad break every 7 minutes. And that really disrupted the flow of the episode. I'm like, I don't know how people do this watching with ads anymore, because it felt like it prevented the show from getting any momentum, you know, for me.
Did watch this on Hulu too, and I noticed that too. I was like, oh, this scene seems to have a cut to black that's a clear ad break,
right,
a little bit sooner than I expect.
Right.
Even I noticed it watching it on Hulu. It didn't bump me as much, but I definitely felt it to a degree.
Yeah, there were a lot of ad breaks, like right as the show was picking up steam, I'd be like, ooh, I'm getting into it, and then ad break. And it's like, oh, that really... Now I'm hearing about, you know, herpes medicine instead of immersing myself in the world of Scandia, North Dakota. So anyway, and I agree with you that the very end of this season was truly masterful, beautiful, one of the great final moments of any season of television. If they ended the show here, it would be like a really wonderful ending. So overall, love the season. Some great swings, as you said, throughout the second half of the season. And the finale was pretty good, pretty solid, a little bit weird in some places and ways we'll talk about. But the way it actually all wrapped up was very satisfying, I thought. So, yeah, I think we both really liked this season of television quite a bit. All right, Jesse Earl, before we get to the finale, I guess we should talk about, like, are there any moments leading up to the finale you want to highlight? And I think, you know, I will start the conversation off like this. I think we have talked on this podcast before about how I, David Chen, tend to not like episodes that are dream sequences because I'm already watching a fictionalized construct of something. If you, the creator of the show, want to communicate something to me, just use the construct. We already know that it's all fake. Like, just give it to me. Give me the story and the message in that way. And so I usually hate dream sequences. Mm-hmm. And this show made a dream sequence or dream-like sequence that I did not hate. I was like, oh, wow, that's actually really interesting the way they did that, right? And I think this would be...
I think it was episode eight.
Episode seven. Yes, seven and Camp Utopia. The episode is called Linda. But Dot has this kind of extended dream sequence while she is asleep at a roadside diner, basically. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you wanted to highlight this, Jesse. What were your thoughts on Linda and what happens in that episode?
I love this, especially how it comes back in the last two episodes, because the whole episode is Dot going to this like weird kind of the survivor camp for women where everyone's named Linda and they're named after this woman, Linda, who we kind of get the backstory of Dot and where, why her relationship is to John Hamm's character and everything in this episode. And we learn that the Linda who runs this camp is essentially John Hamm's wife, who kind of set her up to be abused by him after they had taken her in, Dot in. And then when Linda sort of escaped, she didn't take Dot with her, and Dot sort of having this anger at her for being like, you left me with this man who then continued to abuse me and use me and all, and put her in the situation of being made into his wife and being an object for him. And the episode is her kind of working through and processing really beautifully, like how this anger that she has towards Linda is in a degree misplaced, but understandable, of like how Linda was dealing with all of this and was dealing with this abuse, was just trying her best in a really crappy situation and really wrestling what it's like to be women in abusive situations and with abusive guys in domestic violence towards children, adults. And then when it's revealed to be a dream sequence that she was just having, and you realize that it was her processing that anger towards Linda. And then also like the other women also being named, all that y'all took on the name Linda in her dream, which sort of showcases like this idea that like all women kind of who suffer domestic violence kind of have a similar deal with similar issues and stories, and how she would fit into that same narrative as well. It was a really, really beautiful way of just showcasing how women who are victims of domestic violence process that survivor's guilt, that anger, like it, all the different parties involved. And then when it comes back in the finale, where we learn that Linda actually didn't survive and that she was killed by John Hamm. I'm blanking on his name, character name again, but I usually have names in front of me. But
Roy Tillman, right?
Roy, yeah, thank you. I'm always bad with names. But when we learn that, and then she has this last moment where she says, oh, she didn't actually escape. She was just something that I thought of in like a beautiful dream. It just kind of encapsulates this whole idea of like how domestic violence survivors like process stuff and how all women can't necessarily escape that. Some women do die and don't get to escape the abuse that they're under. It was, I think it really captured it really well. And I think the use of the dream sequence, like showcased that as just part of the process of healing and dealing with it, that I think was really great.
The dream sequence is also extremely elaborate, very detailed, and the characters all had this way of describing their past traumas where they needed to pick a doll or make a puppet, oftentimes in a process that would take weeks or months, and then play act out what happened to them. And I just thought that was a really interesting way of conveying this character's backstory without the use of flashback, right? You know, in a typical scenario, we might have a flashback where, and then it's like, when you make a flashback, how do you make it? Do you use a warm filter? Do you use like a pro mist filter that makes everything look fuzzy and bright? Like, what do you do? And they just got around all that by saying, hey, let's make it hyper stylized and tell it from Dot's perspective. I thought that was just an interesting decision as well. So I thought it was really just an impressive sequence. And then it's, of course, concluded by Dot getting hit by a truck, you know, like, a truck hits a car that then hits Dot, which is like an incredible way to end that sequence. And it wasn't clear to me if John Hamm's character had engineered that in some way, or if he just was able to locate her after she was at the hospital. I don't think he engineered it. That seems pretty elaborate, but I don't know what your interpretation of that was.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I thought Roy's son did that. I think there's some reference to that, but I don't remember.
Very possible.
What I will also say too, just jumping off of your like the stylization too with the puppets, is it also make sure the show doesn't sensationalize the abuse, because oftentimes when shows are dealing with abuse and they depict it, it has a tendency, even if unintentionally, to sensationalize it or glorify it or like be traumatizing to watch, even in some ways,
right,
people.
Right, yeah.
And by having it this way, it allows Dot to take ownership of it and also not sensationalize it through like actually physically depicting it.
Absolutely. I'm trying to think of any other kind of moments along the way that are worth highlighting. Danish Graves, you know, there's this kind of interesting moment where Danish Graves, Dave Foley's character, he kind of decides to go and try to rescue Dot on his own. And I think it's supposed to be this character moment for him, but his death is certainly tragic. And also the whole plot where he has three dudes change their name to Roy's name is incredible. Like just,
I love ingenious, that. I was going to call that out.
Just an ingenious, plot line. And then he goes to try to rescue Dot at the end. And I think what the show is trying to do at the end is kind of like making you feel like these characters, specifically Dave Foley's character, specifically Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, have become better people along the way, right? The Danish is like, hey, I'm going to try to save this woman even if it endangers me. And of course, Jennifer Jason Leigh finally seeing Dot as a daughter. I certainly bought it more for Jennifer Jason Leigh's character than for Danish Graves' character. Like, what did you think of how that character's plotline resolved?
So Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, I actually have more conflicted thoughts, but I'll talk about that when we get to the finale, because I actually think her storyline, to a degree, rubs me wrong compared to the rest of the episode's themes. But with Graves' character, I actually did like how he dies, because my read on it was him trying to be, like, the dude's savior, who thinks he can, like, come in and like, be the rescuer for her and, like, save the woman, save the day, even though he's not even the person with the power in the situation. Like, the women can ultimately save themselves in the show, which I really do like as a theme. But he's sort of like, yeah, I can do this. I'm smart enough. And then he ultimately just gets casually murdered because he just thinks he's protected by his power, privilege, and place, and he's not all that. So that was my kind of read on it. I think it would have worked a little bit better if we had gotten more of his character a little bit, because he's very much just an agent of Jennifer Jason Leigh throughout most of the season, and we don't really get a lot of his perspective or views on things, so it doesn't it doesn't hit as hard when he dies. But I still got what the show is going for, and it does land, if not as strong as it could have.
Yeah, and I think, like, part of the reason it lands is just the viciousness, you know, the way in which he's murdered by John Hamm's character. I do think the show does a good job of making it so that the recklessness with which John Hamm's character murders people rises as you get towards the end of the show. Like, he's always murdered people. Like, he's never been a good person, but, like, it seems like he's taking bigger and bigger risks, murdering Danish Graves, murdering his father-in-law, like, just, like, really going out there. And I did appreciate how things were felt like they were really spinning out of control for that character. Anything else before we get to the final episode? I'm trying to think if there's any other major things to mention, but yeah, I think those are some of the bigger plot lines. The dream episode, the Danish Graves debate heist, as it were. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I should say, I meant to actually pop on that with the Graves sequence. I did love you mentioned the politician storyline, and I did love that, because, again, it kind of goes to this, like, oh, the fact that there's not really choices in a lot of elections is just you're voting for different shades of the same thing, which I thought was a very clever way to bring that into the show. And sort of, it kind of reminded me a little bit of, like, the Republican primary that we have been having going on lately. It's just, like, different shades of awful, and none of them are good. They're all just terrible. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an interesting bit.
Yeah, and it is seated wonderfully in the opening scene too, where he goes to the registrar or whatever it is to, like, change everyone's names to the same thing. It's just a really, really well done plot, executed wonderfully. And you really get a sense of tit for tat, cat and mouse, kind of like these two larger than life figures battling it out. And I really, like, in an escalating game against each other, that in a way that I really appreciated. So, what else to mention before the end? Oh, yeah, it is worth mentioning Gator's storyline, which does come to a really satisfying conclusion in the final episode. Mm-hmm. But Gator, there's something extremely tragic about that character, right? And how he is not murdered, but he is just maimed, right, and forced to live in shame for the rest of his life. When you and I recorded the first half of this and we predicted the ending for these characters, I don't think either of us predicted that one of the characters would be maimed horribly and forced to, like, live in the shadow of their father for the rest of their lives. There's something really tragic, because there's something almost, I don't feel bad for the character at all, but it's just, like, there's something almost, there's an inevitability to it. Like, he was Shakespearean almost, like, he was fated, Greek tragedy, like, he was fated to do this because he couldn't let it go, right? He was instructed to give Monk the cash and just pay him off, because John Hamm's character very rightfully thought to himself, hey, we need fewer variables in the situation. Just give him the money, and then we don't need to deal with that character anymore. and he couldn't let it go. He went back to get the money back and wanted to show him who's boss and who's the man, against his father's wishes, and suffered horribly because of it. You know, paid like a really horrible price for it. So I just thought that was a very satisfying, thematically rich, satisfying sort of ending for that character.
I loved it too, because it reminds me, and it kind of goes to like the whole show's themes of debt and cycles of violence, of how he is a victim of abuse too, as we learn of Roy Tillman, who verbally abuses him and abuses him in other ways too, as we get from Dot's perspective. But he kind of reminds me of like those like alt-right incel-y kind of folks who just like are told that they deserve the world, told to be these strong men, but feel so ineffectual at dealing with the world or being able to change things, because the ways that they're offered to solve things is usually through violence or force, and that, and not actually changing the systems that cause them to be in this place, like that are abused by people like his father and Roy, who's clearly like a Trump allegory or some authoritarian strongman allegory. And so ultimately just lashes out in whatever ways that he can find to find power. And that just harming the woman that Mook is staying with, ultimately getting killed by him and like just hurting marginalized folks. And so he kind of reminds me just of those, like those radicalized young men who feel like they should lash out in violence because their leader tells them to, or else they're seen as not really men, but ultimately are just ineffectual and causing harm that doesn't really help anybody and even hurts themselves, even though we could be able to empathize, but it doesn't erase the damage that they do nor the accountability that they should have.
Interesting. You know, I think it's more of a different archetype. Like, I think of a Kendall Roy or Ziggy from season 2 of The Wire, Ziggy Sabatka, you know, this kind of character who like has a really charismatic father who has done amazing things theoretically, and then who's like really desperately trying to live up to that and just, you can tell, literally never can.
Even Kendall, if we're talking that with, oh, sorry, I cut you off. Apologies.
Yeah, no. John Hamm's own show, like he's the Pete Campbell to John Hamm's Don Draper, you know. So anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah. I thought you would finish. No worries. Jumping in, even with Kendall too, it kind of the same thing in Succession, where he minor spoilers for that show, but like he does sort of have that like, oh, I can't, I'm not as effectual as my father or this guy who I'm supposed to look up to, and then literally helps cause fascism to get into American government because he's
right.
It's the same sort of concept. These people who feel emasculated in some way, helping.
Yeah, I think Succession shows sometimes the effects can be really dire of that need for parental approval. And in the case of Gator, I would say I'm sure Gator has inflicted much harm and misery, but like the damage feels a little bit more contained, thankfully, in the Gator case. Yeah. Very local, very localized to the Scandia area, I think, probably. So, yeah.
So sort of the access to power that they have is how much equivalent to how much damage they can do.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, totally, totally.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
All right, Jesse Earl, let's get to the finale episode of the show. I'm just going to say the first 20 to 30 minutes of this finale I thought were pretty weird. Because here's the thing. This show has been building up to this massive confrontation between Roy Tillman's ranch, a bunch of his people, and multiple branches of the militarized U.S. government, basically, like, you know, the police and SWAT and the FBI and the military. Like, and it feels like it's building up to the mother of all confrontations. And then, and here's the thing, like, in general, when I'm watching a television show, I don't need to see tons of action. Like, I'm more interested in the drama and the interactions in general. But this is a show that proved it can do both. And so I was thinking to myself, hey, if this show wants to be 30 minutes of just straight action, you know, you have my permission to do that, Fargo Season 5, because you have earned it through, like, everything you've done this season. And I have to say, the actual raid itself is very short and underwhelming. Very little actually happens. And what does happen is kind of weird. You know, there's this moment when John Hamm's character murders his father-in-law in a fit of rage, turns the corner, and then, you know, his wife kind of lures him around the corner, which is like, I don't think that's something we saw coming. Did they set that up in the last episode?
I don't think so. I actually think it was, again, this is where it gets kind of messy. I think that the way it was supposed to play was that she had just ran away and Dot happened to be there at that time and they weren't working together. It was just she happened to be there too.
Yeah, that was confusing, if so. You know?
Yeah, it wasn't clearly communicated.
Right. Yeah, so anyway, and then Dot shoots him in the stomach, and then he kind of gets away before he's eventually apprehended. But yeah, I just thought, I was really looking forward to like a massive... We spent 3 to 4 episodes trying to go to the fireworks factory, and I thought we were going to get to the fireworks factory, and then we got there, and then like one firework went off, and that was kind of it. Now... that's not to say like I definitely needed to have that for the episode to be good, but it just felt like a little bit of a anticlimax compared to what I thought we were leading up to. Jesse Earl, what'd you think?
I actually thought that was one of the episode's better decisions, because for me, that confrontation is kind of what Roy wanted. Like, he wanted to have this big blaze of glory, and certainly he wanted to be the one that came out on top of that. Like, a small man taking on big U.S. government guy, I'm the real badass, manly man dude. But even if he had lost that fight, like, it still ultimately serves to, like, depict him as this, like, big, strong, brave dude who took on the government. Like, the show is wrestling with these ideas of, like, the cycles of violence and the like, need to be the strongest, toughest, baddest, and how that, like, that desire to like be the rugged individualist authoritarian ultimately just continues replicating harm over and over and over and over again, that even this sort of like fight with the big government idea kind of still fits within his conceptualization of like kill or be killed, tiger or predator prey, like the whole idea of showing like you're tiger, you're predator. Like it fits within that conceptualization. And so by disrupting that and having it be just Dot getting to shoot him, and he just limps away ineffectually and doesn't get his blaze of glory. He even goes like, this end of this tunnel is my destiny. He just gets captured, and it's very offhanded.
Right.
I think that serves the show to like give us that anticlimax, because it kind of fits into the show's themes that we'll talk about, I think, in the final sequence of undercutting those ideas of predator prey, the strongest, toughest man. But I could also see that being, again, it kind of goes with, without spoiling that show, but it goes with The Curse, where it's like a little, I think thematically it fits really well, but it could also leave someone feeling underwhelmed by a finale that swerves from what we expected it to be.
Right. I think as you're talking about it, Jesse, first of all, great defense of the show. I think the other thing that comes to mind as we're talking about it is, this show is heavily inspired by not only the Coen Brothers' Fargo, but also the other movie I would say draws most from is No Country for Old Men. The character of Ulla Monk, I would say, is a cross between Peter Stormare's character in Fargo and Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh character in No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. There's several lines in Fargo that are taken directly from No Country for Old Men. You know, my father was a sheriff, his father too. Like, that's a line that Roy Tillman speaks, but now it's obviously been, or Tommy Lee Jones speaks in No Country for Old Men, but it's obviously been twisted in the mouth of John Hamm's character. And also, No Country for Old Men, as with Fargo, is a those are both works that have extremely exquisitely executed genre thrills, leading you to think that there's going to be some big confrontation at the end. Spoilers for No Country for Old Men, only for like both things to end without a big blaze of glory, as you might expect, right? In fact, it is actively something that is deprived from the audience in a way that is quite purposeful. Certainly for No Country for Old Men. In Fargo, it feels like they still kind of got to have their cake and eat it too. There was a lot of shooting, and they had this thing where like it flashed to black, and it was very stylistic. So we got a little bit of it, but yeah, it's interesting that like it's a great point, Jesse, that who John Hamm sees himself as, like how he glorifies and lionizes himself, even in death, is not something that he is able to have fulfilled in the actual course of events in the show, and I think that is quite purposeful. So anyway, I just want to be clear. I'm not saying that's a mark against the show that it didn't have a big action scene. It just felt to me like that's where the show was leading up to. And also the show had awesome action scenes prior to that point.
That's always the danger of stuff like that, where it's like you build up and then you swerve. And if you do that, it needs to be done with, I think, very real intentions. Which I think the show definitely had. And so I think it works for me, but it does run the risk of disappointing people who were expecting the thing that you said, like, hey, this is what we want or this is what we're going to give you, and you're not giving them that. So
we got to talk briefly about the death of Whit Farr, the state trooper character who gets in a confrontation with John Hamm's character, is murdered by John Hamm's character. And I'm curious what you thought about this. I will say my initial reaction was I was very disappointed because Whit Farr was a good person, like noble character. He's also one of the show's few characters of color. And I think we've seen many TV shows and films where characters of color die to motivate white people. And it would have been nice if the show did something a little bit different than that. I have since read interviews with or seen interviews where the character the actor who plays him talks about how Lamorne Morris, I believe, plays Whit Farr, and talks about how like, hey, it's not that deep. Like, you know, maybe five times out of 10, Whit Farr would have won that confrontation. And like the other five times he wouldn't have, you know, but I don't know. It felt that was the only character who, in my opinion, didn't get what they deserved at the end of this finale, or one of two characters maybe that didn't get what they deserved at the end of this finale. So, Jesse Earl, what'd you think of how Whit Farr's storyline ended in this episode?
I completely agree with you. I found it deeply disappointing to kill him off, especially when his story has been like to try and rescue Dot this whole season, which like there is often like storylines of like people of color, especially black men, being like there to like save the white woman sort of thing and being utilized in that way. And then just to like kill him off, even in a way that's not even like him defending her, it's just sort of like in this offhand way off to the side that isn't even necessary. It adds this, it feels like it's just done to add this sense of tragedy,
right,
of like him still causing violence to this guy who didn't need to die in the last moment. It feels unnecessary. And again, yeah, just like the defense of the actor, and I can, and you know, he's an actor and I understand he wants to defend the thing he's in, but you know, Noah Hawley wrote it. Like, he chose who was going to win and right, die in that scene. So it's like, eh.
Well, he's trying to communicate something about the chaos of, you know, the world. And sometimes the good guy dies, right? In the world, you know? And that's
and
true.
I get that. And that, and that fits Fargo's sort of sometimes, like, not everyone who gets what they want, gets what they deserve, survives, that sort of thing. It fits that kind of tale. But I don't know, to do that with the one of the few characters of color and to do it so seemingly casually, it felt disappointing.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Didn't love how Whit Farr's character ended, you know, because he was like the consistently good person throughout the whole, probably the best human being in the whole show, you know. The one character who was like not corrupted by anything, looking out for the hostage at the end, you know, he's just like the best person, and then he died. Obviously the show's trying to say something with that, but you know, not something we were particularly interested in hearing. Anyway, want to give a shout out to Gators ending with Dot, and you know, he embraces her, and she says she promises to come bring him cookies, and you know, he kind of regresses into like a very childlike state. And the whole opening of the episode too, where he's stumbling around and trying to find everything, and the camera work tilting around and making like mirroring his disorientation, all just really well done, I thought. Gator's storyline just was a home run for me, I thought. Just like really well handled overall. So anything else before we get to the time jump?
No, I just echo your thoughts on Gator. I think it kind of points what I was saying before. It's like we should have empathy for him, but not let him get away with this harm, because it would have been easy for the show to be like, oh, he didn't do anything, he's okay, let him get away. But it's like, no, he's going to be held responsible. But still, there's empathy for why he was the way he was.
All right. So then nothing happens for 1 year. Nothing of significance happens for an entire year. And we get a 1 year later text on the screen. Dot and Indira visit Witfar's grave on the anniversary of his death, where we learned that he had a bunch of sisters that we never met. So that makes it even more sad in some ways, even though we never met those characters, whatever. Then Lorraine visits Roy in prison, and they have a final confrontation. You know, Roy's trying to put on a good face, but Lorraine has not only bought the judge, but she's also bought all the prisoners and is going to make Roy's life a living hell. And I guess, first of all, that's a very proper ending for Roy. So Roy also gets what he deserves. Love that. The only thing that I was curious about with this whole Lorraine storyline is Lorraine stays on top. Like, nothing basically happens to Lorraine. She's completely fine. And that's fine with me, because that was what would happen in real life, right? But Indira, I kind of am curious, like, what we're to make of Indira, because she ends up working for Lorraine. And I'm just going to tell you, right now, Jesse, I'm guessing that's a hard job, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so Indira has kind of traded in part of her soul for money, but that's just never really addressed at all. And so I was a little bit disappointed we didn't get some more sense of what Indira was thinking towards the end there. But as for Lorraine and Roy, great ending, no complaints. What are your thoughts?
I actually have a more conflicted view on this.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stuff happening in it that I like and a lot of it that I don't like. So the stuff with Roy, I love his statement about like, yeah, the prison's actually how the way the world should work. Because like the show has been very critical of like the institutions and systems that sort of create these hierarchical dynamics. And so Roy sort of being like, oh yeah, the prison system where we shove a lot of like people of color into, and we like put people against each other, dehumanize people this whole time. Like, of course he views that like hierarchy as something that works for his very authoritarian view of the world. So like perfect decision. And also the fact that he's wearing like, I think he has like a swastika on his neck.
I don't think it's a swastika, but it was a neck tattoo for, it might've been a swastika. It was a neck tattoo for sure.
It was very evocative of it, if it wasn't for sure. So probably a white supremacist group symbol or something like that, that he probably joined while in there. But then, with Linda, I wish the show, because the show, especially in earlier in the season, was very critical of her as a capitalist, and seemed very hyper aware of like stuff where she even gives like a speech about debt and how she controls people through debt.
Lorraine, I think you're referring to, not Lorraine.
Sorry, what did I say? I meant Lorraine, not Linda. Controls people through debt, and controls people through capital. And then the show is even aware even more so of like she has a whole speech about how the police are there as an enforcement of both state and private property power. That is what capitalism is based on. She has that whole thing there. It's like you are there to hurt the little people. You are there to enact our will to Indira earlier in the season. And so to have this scene where it's sort of seen as triumphant that she is now going to like punish Roy with violence and using her capitalist means to like influence that.
Yeah.
Feels like it runs against the series point that it's going to make in the very next scene, which is restorative and breaking this idea of like debt owes debt. And I think And the reason I dislike it is not because it's not true to who her character is. I think it's very true to her character.
Yeah.
It's just the show presents it uncritically as almost like, yeah, now Roy's going to get it.
Yes.
Don't you feel some sense of like,
right.
isn't that great? And I wish there'd been like a sense of like, this is what's going to happen to him. And isn't that a little bit scary or dark?
Mm-hmm.
But it sort of presents it as like this triumphant, like rah, rah, she wins moment. And it kind of leans into this like girl boss feminist thing that the show also kind of has where like she is part of saving Dot and they have this like moment of connection where like, yeah, we understand each other. And it sort of ends on this uncritical look at all these things that the show is very clearly aware of Lorraine's place within this, you know, framework of capitalism, statehood and all that stuff and debt. And it doesn't really address it. So like, and it literally runs counter the emotion that it's trying to get in us of like enjoying the reveling in Roy's punishment, seems to run counter directly to the very next scene. And then, with Adira, it remains uncritical of the police in that as well. Like, and we also supposed to get like the American government comes in and captures Roy and like all of that stuff is like the show is aware of how these systems work. And then it sort of ends on a big, like, we're not going to really criticize it at the end, which feels like a very much drop ball that disappointed me.
Yeah. I don't know if, I think you're probably right, Jesse. You know, like, I want to try and push back and say, like, I don't know if uncritically is correct there. Like, maybe it leaves it up for you to decide. But I agree with you that based off of the final scene, the reaction we as the audience should have to everything Lorraine does is horror. Like, wow, I can't believe she's manipulating the system to her ends in this way. And that's the problem is the show, I think the show's hatred of the Roy Tillman character is stronger than its belief in the overwhelming power of love. You know what I'm saying? You know, like,
yeah,
like
yeah.
It's like the Roy Tillman character is so reprehensible that literally anything that is used to defeat that character and punish that character, make that character suffer, is justified.
Yeah.
And that is undercut, you know, by what happens in the next scene where, you know, the Ulla Munk character's plotline gets resolved. Because I think you're right that there is at least a part of that scene with Lorraine where the creators of the show want us to revel in Roy's suffering. Yeah, like, I don't know if it's 100% that. Like, maybe a part of us can be like, wow, Lorraine's really abusing the system and that's bad. But I think you're right. The way it's shot, the way, like, Lorraine triumphantly walks out of it and everything, you know, like, I do think you're right that, like, that's probably what they wanted us to take away from that scene. And that is very conflicting with what happens in the final scene of the episode. So,
yeah. And to defend myself a little bit and kind of just bouncing off of what you just said, like, it's not that I don't think Roy shouldn't be held accountable and that we shouldn't feel some sense of satisfaction in that, but it's the vindictiveness that I think that is centralized in that scene that we're supposed to empathize with that I think is what cuts across, I think, what the show is ultimately trying to say.
Right. Like, I mean, there is a moment when Roy looks at the cigarette she's given him and kind of realizes like he's fucked. And you know, so there is that kind of darkness to it. It's not like there's none of that. But I do agree that my sense from the scene was Lorraine has triumphed and we're supposed to celebrate that triumph in some way. And that's not great. It like doesn't fit in really with anything the rest of the show has been doing. So final scene, Monk has been biding his time for a year and he shows up like randomly, coincidentally on the same week where Lorraine, you know, Whitfar's 1 year anniversary. And also when Lorraine confronts John Hamm and says there is a debt yet to be paid, you know, Monk has, by the way, his name is Ulla Monk. Ulla, if I recall correctly, is a name of one of the nihilists in The Big Lebowski, and also this character in Fargo is also a nihilist, so definitely drawing from the entire Coen Brothers oeuvre. And he says, like, a debt has to be paid. Jesse, any thoughts of what that debt was in your opinion? Like, what was he asking for? Any guesses as to what that was?
Well, he says like the pound of flesh was taken, and I think either like the guy that worked for him died in like the first episode,
yeah. Or his
like,
ear was injured, burned,
something along those lines. Yeah. Just like the damage was done to me, so I need to inflict it upon you in some way. Again, going into that like cycle of violence, vindictiveness, getting back what you're owed theme that the show has been wrestling with all season.
Yeah. So he wanted to injure her in some way or kill her, right? Injure or kill her probably is kind of
or hurt her. And this kind of goes with injure, but like hurt her family as well or something like,
Yeah. But Jesse Earl, it turns out the real Fargo was love.
was the friends we made along the way.
the real Fargo was love. And, I think this is best summed up by a friend of mine, Brendan, who DM'd me after the Fargo season finale and wrote, "I mostly love the finale, but I especially love the idea of what if you gave Welsh Anton Chigurh orange pop and made him bake muffins?"
yeah, I love it so much.
I think the show took it like a little bit far, you know, where it's very funny Monk's communication style juxtaposed with Dot's family. You know, he's like, the debt must be paid. Like, a man does not release a tiger for no reason. And, you know, Dot's husband is like, you know, we saw a tiger at the zoo the other day. You know, like, that's very funny. And I think the show almost, like, overplays it a little bit, you know, gets, like, you know, draws that out a little bit too far. But overall, I think it's highly amusing. And throughout the course of this time period, Dot is trying to convince Ula to not hurt them. and she manages to succeed by helping him make Bisquick and feeding it to him. On that note, by the way, I do want to mention the episode title of the finale is Bisquick without the C, right? Bisquick, the product, has a C in it, but Bisquick in the show, no C.
Interesting.
If you go to Reddit, the Fargo subreddit, a user named I'm a Max writes the following. Bisquick without C, trigger warning, overanalysis of trivial details. Many notable theory crafters on the subreddit were puzzling over why the finale's title is spelt this particular way. For those unaware, the actual product's name is Bisquick with a C. In reality, the reason for the difference is either a typo ignorance or some nebulous licensing reason. But that's not so fun, so I present my interpretation. When asked by Wayne about his origin, Monk says he's from across the sea. Sea sounds like sea, and you know where I'm going with this. The absence of sea, or C-S-E-A, represents removal of the spiritual barrier between the characters, and the title refers to the cooking supply's supernatural ability to facilitate this. I'm very sorry. End quote.
I actually have a different interpretation, over analysis of it that was probably not intended. If I may present mine, it's removing the... Because the show is ultimately being very critical of capitalism and capitalism's influence on this sort of like, we owe a debt to people. Because this whole like theme of debt comes up in this sequence of like debt that we owe people. And like Lorraine is a debt collector, and we saw that connect into it earlier on. Like these themes of debts that are owed to people that give people who have the debt power over you. And capitalism was within that. So removing the C means it's removing the product nature of it, how we see each other as dehumanized things to just enact our will upon. That's my overall analysis.
So the C that's gone stands for capitalism, in other words. Wow.
Yes. But I also have a theory, too, about the Bisquick as well that I think is actually more intentional.
I didn't think I could hear a theory that was more of a stretch than the Reddit one I read, but you have delivered. All right.
I'm trying.
All right. What else? What's your other theory?
Well, I guess I'll just talk about the scene as a whole and why I really, really, really adore it to death. Like, I adore this whole final sequence because of all the things that it is bringing up with Mook's character. he references, like, we learned he actually is the supernatural being for that.
Yes,
we saw
he is a 500-year-old supernatural creature.
That is confirmed.
Right?
Here.
It's confirmed. I mean, if we take him at his word, you know, I asked my wife, do you think he's speaking metaphorically in that? And she's like, no, he's absolutely a supernatural creature who's been around for 500 years. So.
And this gets into, again, this is going to be over analysis, but I actually will argue that I think this is the very much intention of this, is like he's saying he came over as a slave and people died and were killed, kind of connecting to the like a practice of like slavery and the colonialism of the era. He even references that he like became part of the indigenous tribes, which like there's probably something I would like to hear criticism from indigenous folks about, like this guy becoming one with the indigenous people and becoming that. There's a criticism there to be made that's not mine to make. But I think the point of that is to say, like, he is this force of this person who like was part of these people that were here before in a supernatural way, that were like before this idea of private property and ownership and controlling others, and how he was traumatized through that process of colonialization with the coming of the musket and violence, as he literally references, into becoming part of this idea of debt and debt owed, and how it harms those who are in the lower class seen as usable, and how he literally ate the debt of the rich people, and that caused him to become this person who was like, I owe debts to people, I owe debts to others. And he even references Catholicism and the idea of like Catholicism being used to do that colonialization, because the show makes numerous references to God in both this scene and other ones, where like Roy Tillman references like the Lord, I am the Lord's man, like I am enacting his will, and the sort of like fact that the debt collecting was done again at like a religious ceremony, as we saw earlier, and then earlier in the scene like they do the Lord's prayer, and so there's references to the religious aspect of it. And the thing that Dot does to sort of disrupt this whole idea of like, you don't have to buy into that system anymore. You don't have to buy into believing that there's debt owes to people. We can just forgive and be kind and care about each other. Disrupting this whole idea of breaking down that sort of those lines of capitalism, state owned, like property, colonialism, breaking it all down in that one scene. And she does so by offering him bread. A bread of forgiveness at her table, which is clearly meant to, like, I think meant to reference like the whole like Jesus is like bread, my body is my bread, and pound of flesh even gets references like that giving of the bread is supposed to give forgiveness, and like rooting itself in the actual views of Catholicism that like move beyond the colonial aspect of it and the power aspect of it, just like finding caring in like in community and care and the common people, and just sort of like bringing it back to that root. And so I think that bread is sort of reference that. And so this whole scene is, I think, just a really good foundational, like it by using him as a supernatural being, it's sort of getting to the core essence of what I think the show is trying to say, is that vindictiveness, owing debts, controlling people through control of money, property, that sort of thing is the problem, and how we break through that is just seeing each other as human beings and caring for each other and forgiving each other. And I think ending on that note, I think is beautiful. And I think you said it earlier during our spoiler free section, is like, if this is the final note that like this show ends on, like there's no other season, I think that this is a really perfect end to everything. Both Fargo, the show, and Fargo, the movie, we're trying to get at with a lot of their themes. Like, I could see more being done, but I feel like this is just a great encapsulation of a way to kind of give a hopeful view on a series that has overall seemed very nihilistic.
Mm. Beautifully said, as usual, Jesse. Yeah, there is something very biblical about the way we talk about debt. Debt is forgiven or honored, or, you know, it must be paid. And I think that the thing I really appreciated about this season of television is it is a repudiation. You know, I grew up as a Christian, and I have since I've since left the faith, but I, you know, I'm deeply familiar with the culture and the beliefs and the tenets and everything. And one of the most upsetting things to witness over the course of the last decade is, you know, if I hadn't left it 10 years ago, I would have left it 8 years ago, because, you know, like, yeah. One of the things that's been most upsetting to witness is how the evangelical church has traded in their soul for power. They have embraced Donald Trump, who is, I'm just going to put it out there, one of the least biblical leaders I think this country has ever seen. And it's almost like, oh, like the veneer of what they were trying to accomplish has faded away, and now all that's left is this lust for power, because he's not an honorable person and doesn't even know how to give lip service to the Bible correctly, like other people who have been not honorable in the past. And so it was a really kind of glass-shattering moment for me and the church. And what we have seen this season is – and with this ending is two visions of what Christian, you know, the Christian ideals can be. We have, on the one hand, Roy Tillman, who knows the Bible back and forth, professes love for God, twists the words of the Bible to use towards his end, uses the Bible and the word as a cudgel with which to enact his will. And then we have, on the other hand, Dot, who just wants a loving suburban life, and you know, in her confrontation with Ulla Munk, to love him, you know, to share love with him, and to say, hey, the suffering that you have endured does not need to continue, because we can break the cycle of trauma and violence through love, through an act of love, or through acts of love. And in that, there's two visions of how religion, God's, specifically Christianity, can be lived out in the world today. And we see it play out in those ways today. And I think the show takes a really strong position on which vision is more desirable and actually more in line with the Word of God.
Yeah.
It's the less flashy, more forgiving, more loving one, and it often doesn't look like what you would think it looks like. Yeah. In fact, it's often very hidden. You know, like no one knows that Ulla is at this house and enjoying this meal with his family. It's an act of kindness that no one's going to really know about, and that is often what true generosity and true Christian love is. So, you know, I found a lot to resonate with as somebody who has been really dismayed by the evangelical church's embrace of Donald Trump, which, by the way, we just saw this week with Iowa and the caucuses. Mm-hmm. And the huge evangelical population in Iowa, and like they are largely responsible for his victory there. And so it's definitely highly, highly relevant, in my opinion. So that was my take on it. Go ahead.
No, just to add one little coda on what you're saying too, is like I'm someone also grew up Catholic as well, Roman Catholic on my mom's side, like literally did the rosary. My family did the rosary every week, or every day, I should say. And I'm also someone who is agnostic now in my life, and have been for a very long time. But so just echoing that, I feel that as well. And then also too, just you made me think about how this echoes this sequence, and even kind of referenced a little bit with Ulla sort of talking about like the practice of debt and eating and all that jazz, going back to like the Reformation and Martin Luther like nailing the theses on the door of the church, because the whole reason that happened was because the Catholic Church was like saying you can get into heaven by paying. You pay money,
and you
can get into the church. You pay off your debts and give us more money, give us more power, and thereby you can get into the kingdom of God or whatever. And that sort of Martin Luther pushing back against that whole idea that because it was ultimately just there to make money for the church.
Yeah, the indulgences, right? And
exactly.
And what this season has asked is like, what is the net effect of that? Like, who suffers in that situation? What is the cost to society of continuing to subjugate people via debt in that way?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to do it with a bunch of shooting and killing, you know, which is like obviously like very enjoyable to watch. But I think it's grasping for something deeper. And I think largely it you know, is able to achieve that grasp. So
mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts on the season 5 finale of Fargo, Jesse Earle?
No, like I said, I mean, clearly there's a lot here to talk about and a lot of deep stuff being said. Like I said, I think there's small things here and there that I wish could have been a bit better, like the treatment of the one officer, as well as like Lorraine's ending. But on the whole, I think this is a really powerful and strong ending of this series, of the season, and potentially the series that I really loved. So
yeah, and the final shot ending with, you know, Ula, like, kind of the first time we see that character smile in the whole movie, I think, or the whole series, you know, is just delightful and a wonderful note to end the show on. So, yeah, I had a great time. I was very moved by the ending. And, of course, they use, you know, they made their own little version of the Fargo theme song. I don't know if you know this, for yeah. Fargo season one. Like, they did a variation of Carter Burwell's score from the original Fargo, but multiple times during season five, they actually used the actual theme from the Fargo movie, and the ending was one of those times. And it's a very beautiful, haunting score, and I think they used it to great effect. So, yeah, I loved it. It was a great season of television. Thank you so much for talking about it with me, Jesse Earle. You want to let people know they can find more of your work on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube. Just look up Jesse Gender, you'll find me. I've been having a few different videos that come out there. I do video essays on science fiction, pop culture, and a lot of the political themes. So if you like basically the conversation we had here, I do more of that in video essay format on my channel. I just recently did a video essay talking about the capitalist realism of a lot of science fiction, such as For All Mankind, and how that ties into like Elon Musk and the corporatization of space with SpaceX, and talking all about that with the wonderful astrophysicist, Dr. Aaron McDonald, who is my close friend and the science advisor for the Star Trek franchise. So check out that if you want a similar conversation. And then I'm also at Jesse Gender After Dark, which is another YouTube channel I have where I do reviews of different shows in sort of a more bite-sized format. So that's there for you. And then I'm on all the social medias, mainly Blue Sky and the artist formerly known as Twitter. And I am also on Nebula, which is the streaming service created by a bunch of YouTubers to put our videos outside of the YouTube algorithm. And it is also funding my upcoming science fiction film called Identities, which stars the wonderful John Delancey of Star Trek, Abigail Thorne of Philosophy Tube on YouTube, and numerous other wonderful folks. So check that out when it releases. It's looking like in the first half of this year, though, towards the end of the first half of this year. So check that out.
Wonderful. And I do want to give a shout out to the new Decoding TV weekly format. Be sure to check that out. Decoding TV is becoming basically a weekly show. We'll still do This Week in Streaming on occasion, but it's mostly going to be the weekly show. And so I hope people will tune into that. We're covering True Detective, Night Country, Echo. We'll probably be covering Masters of the Air. There's a bunch of stuff coming out in February and March. So stay tuned and enjoy all the stuff on the channel. Until next week, we'll see you later. Goodbye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.